but I passed the breath test. This is McDaniel Reynolds with the Reynolds Defense Firm, and we specialize in one thing. We represent good people facing DUI charges. While you know that it's illegal to drive with a .08 or greater blood alcohol content, not everyone knows that you could be arrested in Oregon for an alcohol DUI even if you blow well under a .08. This is a pretty loose standard, and it's a way that many of the good people we represent find themselves needing our help when they thought they were doing everything right. The Reynolds Defense Firm. We're solid, we're here if you need us, and we are very good at what we do.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
So let me get this straight. We've got Major League Baseball giving us a Mariners-Tigers Game 5 of the American League Division Series. We've got Oregon and Indiana on Saturday, and College Football Game Day in Eugene. And everybody acting like, well, it's not a big deal. Game Day here comes in Eugene all the time. That might be true. Oregon State looking for their first win of the season. They've got a Wake Forest team that might be looking a little past Oregon State. Is it a trap game for the Demon Deacons and Jake Dickert? NFL, we got a Thursday night football game and a full slate of action over the weekend. The NBA preseason has started. A lot of chatter about LeBron. Hey, what'd you think of the Blazers, Steven, preseason game?
It was fun to watch the Blazers play. There was a lot of freaking out because Shaedon Sharpe played really well, and some backups played really well. Just want to remind everybody, there was Mario Hezonja, Nick Stauskas, Harry Giles, Torin Green hype as well in the preseason. Let's pump the brakes a little bit. But our boy Jan Hansen, I'll tell you what, he has a fan base, and the Blazers are going to be talked about nationally because of him. Like, he has a whole country that watches him and follows him everywhere he goes. He was just stretching before the game, John. He had a giant crowd of people watching him.
Everybody's gathered around, gawking, rubberneck. What is it about him? Is it that, you know, here's a guy who is coming over from China? Is it his size? Is it his ability? Is it his great, bubbly, and upbeat personality? What is
I think it's just because he's Chinese. I think they have a huge love for basketball, especially the NBA. We saw that back in, 2008 when the Olympics was there in Beijing. I believe you were there. Like, they just love the NBA. And so,
went nuts.
Yeah, they haven't had a draft pick since, I believe, 2007. And so for Jan Hansen, you know, he's going to have a fan base. And I think if he's any good at all, American fans are going to like him too, because he does have a funny personality to go with it. And so I think the Blazers, you know what, if he can play or not, if he can play, the Blazers got kind of a goal.
Oh, yeah, especially on top of all that, if he can actually play, it would be awesome.
That would be beneficial.
He's not just some Chinese guy in a Blazers uniform, if he's not, you know.
He looked a little young, I thought, in the preseason game. You looked young, and the refs kind of picked on him a little bit. He didn't know what was going on. It was kind of funny.
It's true, in Beijing in 2008, a couple of weird things happened. Well, you know, they have, you know, in China, this huge fascination with everything American. And if you go to the silk market, you'll understand. The silk market is just this giant marketplace, and you go in there, and there's a lot of Americanized goods that are in there that are knockoffs that are being sold at a huge discount. You want to get that Louis Vuitton bag or whatever it is, yeah, you know, you can get it in there. But anything American looking in that marketplace, you know, really pops. And so the NBA, there's nothing more American than the NBA and, you know, the best basketball in the world and all this stuff. And I just remember going, the first thing is getting off the plane in Beijing, noticing the Yao Ming paraphernalia and marketing that was going on the billboards and the bus stops. It was Yao here, it was Yao there. And then it very quickly hits you like how big Kobe Bryant was. And you go into like their equivalent of the Foot Locker in China. And the mannequins aren't just normal mannequins. The mannequins were literally Kobe Bryant mannequins in the whole store. And I was like, that is a really cool little twist. Not just have a faceless person wearing all this gear. It was Kobe wearing all the different gear. And everybody loved that. And then I went to the USA basketball games, and certainly in a normal Olympics, Everybody goes to swimming. Everybody goes to track and field. Everybody goes to gymnastics. Those are all like big time Olympic sports, regardless of what country you're in. In China, there were a couple of extras that really drew. And one was ping pong, table tennis. And it's their sport. And you go to a park, you know, they're not playing pickup basketball. They're playing pickup ping pong. And then the other one was the Dream Team. Anywhere and anything that the Dream Team did drew huge crowds, large fascination. It's the only time I've ever seen this in a basketball arena where during the pregame introductions, the fans all had their cameras out at the time and their phones out at the time, and they were taking pictures of the images of the NBA players that were on the Jumbotron screen. Like, you could have been in your living room and got that same picture, but they were all just taking pictures over and over. And I was like, hey, wait, the game's going on down there. You don't need to take the picture of the thing up there. But they were just in awe of seeing, you know, Tim Duncan and LeBron and Kobe. And it was their, you know, their reality TV moment. And so to get, I think, Yao in the league, and then I think it was Li Nang was in the league for a little bit, might have been drafted. And then now
Yi Jin Lian, I think, was the last one in 2007.
That last, okay. Yeah. And so it's just like everyone's in a blue moon, right? Like,
right. And that's the thing is, that you talk about how popular Yao was. Like, that was a whole generation. I mean, that was 25 years ago. So, like, there's a brand new generation of kids that haven't seen a Chinese player in the NBA. And now Yang Hansen comes in, first round pick. Like, he's the face of that generation, of a younger generation of, like, these are the kids that are going to watch him play and they're going to be obsessed with him like they were with Yao. So, like, you know, I've read this in Reddit forums where Chinese fans from China will say, look, most Chinese fans, they love the Houston Rockets because of Yao. Like, that's always going to be their number one team. But now the Blazers are, like, defaulted as the number two, like, favorite team.
Are you telling me the Blazers might have done something smart from a marketing perspective here?
And it was when Jody Allen was here. Don't want to give her credit, but you know what?
In spite of Jody, they might have done this. I think it's interesting. Is it fair? Is it fair to Young Hansen, does it put too much pressure on him to expect him to be Yao Ming? I mean, Yao was a difference-making player. Yao was the kind of player that could make you dream about a championship. Is it fair to put that on, Young Hansen at this point of his career?
Yeah, definitely, because he is not that type of player. I mean, Yao Ming was completely different, like you said, 7'6". And
so unfair or fair to put him in that position?
It's unfair, for sure, to expect anything out of a Young Hansen, because I don't expect anything out of him this season. So it's unfair that
way. So what are we doing here? So what are we doing? This is all hype or what?
It's hype right now. It is a lot of hype with him right now, but I will say he has skills that, you know, other 7-footers don't have, but it just... It's not.
Well, what do you see?
He can pass. He can move a little bit. And you know, at 7 feet, you don't find a guy that can really like pass or like catch the ball or dribble. And he can kind of do all those type of things.
He's not a stiff.
Yeah, he's
is
not,
what you're saying.
He's not like the stereotypical 7 foot stiff out there. So
he can do some things some other guys can't.
Right, but
he doesn't fall over himself.
He's not strong enough yet. He's not like IQ wise. He's not smart enough yet to like be in the right position. He'll get fouls, you know, cheap fouls that you can't be getting if you're in the NBA. So he's not going to get a lot of playing time this year. But the hype is going to be there. But it's going to be unfair to expect anything out of him. And I think that's what a lot of fans want is like, yeah, put him out there, see what he can do, make him the most popular guy in the NBA. Well, that's just not going to happen.
Well, I am excited to see him play and to see the hysteria in Portland. And if, you know, the Dodgers have taught us anything about Shohei Ohtani being a star, that if this guy pans out, if this speculative bet pans out by Joe Cronin, you're going to get busloads of people from China who are going to come to Portland and watch this guy play and go into the team shop and buy a $500 jersey or whatever and make it a tourism thing.
It's not just fans outside of Portland. Like at the Dame rally, he was there. He got the biggest pop besides Damian Lillard.
Well, this is interesting. What's he look like when you see him up close, when he's walking around?
Just huge. Just a giant.
Because Yao, I stood next to Yao one time and... Yao made, like, Joel Prisbilla was a large human being. Yao made Prisbilla look like, you know, he was a normal sized person when he was next to him.
He's not like that. He looks like a young kid. Like, his face is very young. Like, he looks like it's a little kid out there, but he's just in a giant body. Like, he's having fun and he looks like he loves life. Like, that's the thing about him, is like, he always is kind of smiling. And it looks like he can't really believe where he's at. So it is kind of cool to see him, but he just looks like a giant kid out there running around.
I do worry about the pressure. I do worry that, because we've seen this, we've seen the pressure of being in that position, just, you know, bury someone, or it just turns out they're not that good. Sebastian Telfair, you know, remember the Blazers had a chance to go get Chris Paul, and they had a chance to go get Deron Williams, then they drafted Martell Webster, and Martell's fine, and Martell's a great guy, and Martell had a respectable career, right? Like, you know, where the Blazers were picking, the expectations for a high school kid at that age, probably unrealistic. Telfair, unrealistic. He was undersized. He was, you know, a good marketing thing for Adidas, but, you know, he wasn't like the next Chris Paul. And now you've got, you know, young Hansen, and everybody expects him to be Yao Ming. What would be making it for him, Stephen? If you look back in his career, you know, is it that he plays 10 years in the NBA and he, you know, makes some All-Star team, makes a couple All-Star teams? What's really making it for him?
Yeah, I mean, that would exceed expectations. I think if you just had a 10-year career and you were playing a part in playoff games, I think that would be making it. Like, if you're either a starter or a key contributor off the bench in big-time games, whether it's the second round, the conference finals, something like that, I think that would be making it for him. Because look, I don't know that he's ever going to be a star with the way the NBA goes, because a lot of 7-footers don't become stars anymore. Like, Jokic is different, and Young Hansen is not him. So, yeah, I think if he can actually prove that he can play in the NBA and he's playing out there in meaningful games, when, you know, when you got Mike Breen on the call and he's yelling bang on every three and Young hits a three, I think that's making it for him. So I think he can do that. It's just going to be a long road for him.
I remember looking at Donovan Klingon about, you know, a month into his rookie season, and I think we were having this conversation on the show, and somebody called in and said, hey, he's going to make some money. It became evident that, like, Klingon, if he stays healthy in the league, he's going to stick around. I hesitate to say this. You know what I'm going to say? I'm kind of encouraged by some of these young players that the Blazers have. I'm encouraged, and, you know, I'm looking at Oklahoma City, who a lot of people are picking to get back, and, you know, could they repeat? And I'm looking at the way the Timberwolves were built, and I'm looking at the Blazers, and I'm like, gosh, they have a lot of interchangeable parts that are interesting. But how do you keep this together? What's the strategy? Do you keep this together and you wait for one or two of these guys to really blossom, and then you bet on those guys, like, you know, Minnesota has done, or the Thunder have done? Or do you try to create this blended roster that is so versatile and so athletic, and, you know, the age, aside from Lillard, everybody's age kind of lines up favorably? Do you try to just, you know, string it out that way? What's the strategy if you're the GM of the Blazers?
I kind of think they're doing it the right way now, and that's just letting everybody develop, because they are still so young at a lot of different key positions. And you look at guys like Shaedon Sharpe, who had a nice night last night. I think he has the most potential on the team. He's been around for 4 years now, John. He's only 22 years old. Like, he's still a young dude that's figuring out his own game, his own life. And I think the hardest part in the NBA is to find that superstar. The Blazers don't have that bona fide guy on their team right now, but they have about 8 or 9, maybe even 10 guys that you could throw on any team in the league, and they'd be like, yeah, I'll take this guy, because he actually plays hard, he plays defense, or they can shoot. They have some type of skill, and the Blazers have those guys.
Do you need a Shai Gilgeous-Alexander?
Yes.
Do you need an Anthony Edwards? Do you need a Kevin Durant, LeBron?
Jason Tatum. The Celtics needs a guy like Jason Tatum or Jaylen Brown on that team. You need that star.
Does the Blazers have a potential star that could be that kind of tentpole on this roster?
Shaedon Sharpe is the one guy that I think can get to that level.
And that's why everybody gets excited when he plays a preseason game well.
Yes, he hits a bunch of threes. He looks good because his game is so effortless. He makes everything look so effortlessly, John. I compare him a lot to Zach LaVine. Like, it just looks like he was born to play basketball, and that's the way Shaedon Sharpe moves. Like, Denny Avdija is still probably their best player right now, but he tries so tremendously hard, and it looks like he's trying really hard. Yeah. Shaedon Sharpe, he just glides up and down the court.
I have a theory about Denny Avdija.
He's awesome. I love that guy.
Okay, but this is why I think fans love him. I think he's like, you know, when you ever watch like a pro golfer and everything looks easy and you go, okay, I can't relate to that. Nothing comes that easy for me.
Yeah.
Advia looks like he's laboring. He looks like he has to work really hard for everything that he gets. I think there is a, dare I say it, kind of a blue-collar mentality about his game that people who are hardworking people appreciate. And I think a fan base like Portland that, you know, you got a lot of people at those games who are probably in the course of their day grinding it out. They're watching a guy grind it out on the court.
I think you're 100% right on that. Because he looks like he is laboring out there, and it is hard. It's hard for him, but then he's successful at everything he does on the court, but he makes it look incredibly hard, and I think a lot of people can relate to that. Like,
does it give people hope? Like, you know, like, hey,
if he could do it, I could do it. Then you realize he's 6'9".
If that guy could play, and look at him, he's getting through his day just like me. It's like Us Magazine when they go, look, you know, Justin Timberlake pumps his own gas, and they put a picture of Timberlake at the pump. That's Denny Advia.
It's actually funny that you say that, because last night we were watching the game, me and Lincoln, my oldest son, and I go, Lincoln, you honestly should watch Denny Advia play and you could play like him, because he's hot. I go, he's tall, he tries really hard, he hustles, and I'm thinking, like, yeah, like anybody could do this, right? You don't have to be tremendously skilled.
Fans love those players.
Love them.
They're very relatable, because most of us can't relate to, you know, the guy taking off at the free throw line and dunking. You know, most of us go, oh, that would be really cool.
I can't dunk between my legs. You know, no matter what I do, I can't do that. But I can take a charge and I can dive on the floor like Denny Advia.
And I tell you, know, Purdue had a player when I was covering Purdue basketball in the late 90s. They had a player named Brian Cardinal who played a little in the NBA. And Cardinal was that player, and the Purdue fans loved him. Okay. And Purdue was good at that time. But I wrote one time, they ought to print Cardinal's number sideways on his jersey, because he was always diving. He was always parallel to the floor, you know. And so it was, you know, taking a charge and diving for a loose ball. And people are like, we love the hustle. And I'm like, I don't think it's the hustle. I actually think it's relatable that most people, you watch a lot of star players, and Kobe, Michael Jordan, sensational competitors, sensational athletes, gifted in a way that most people can't relate to. But I think most of us go through our day feeling like we're hitting our head on the cabinet, we're slipping on a banana peel, we're, you know, you're carrying something to the car, you dropped something, you left something in the house, you forgot it, you have to go back in, you're halfway to work or three quarters of the way to work, and your kid calls and says, hey, my backpack's in your car, and you have to turn around and come back. It is a slog for most people. And I think because of that, we appreciate the players who are like the journeyman player, or maybe the player where it doesn't look so easy, and we go, that guy, yeah, I can relate to what's going on when that player plays. And I don't think, like, I'm trying to think of examples of that, like, in, you know, it's hard when you look like at the Oregon Ducks roster, because you look at them and it's like everybody's a 4 or 5 star player, and everybody is just really gifted and really, you know, it's just DeCorian Moore is ridiculous as a wide receiver. And Dante Moore is fantastic athlete and competitor as a quarterback. And Bear Alexander on defense, you know, he's built like, you know, he should be a bodyguard for Rihanna. Like, it's just like you look at these people and they're just gifted. And then so every once in a while you get like a Jack Coletto, you know, a kid like Cam Scataboo at Arizona State.
Scataboo's a great one.
Yeah, it's just, and you go, man, he's really competing at a high level. And you know, if you get up close, it's misleading, because you get up close and these guys are great athletes to doing what they're doing. But it just looks harder. It just looks like they're grinding through it at a little more difficult pace. Lyle Moivau, when he was quarterback at Oregon State, comes to mind.
Jonathan Smith, when he played.
I even think that, like, you know, there was a little bit of that with, like, Dennis Dixon was a great athlete and a great passer and, you know, a great quarterback. And people go, oh, Dennis Dixon was so skilled. He was skilled. I also think, like, Dennis Dixon played hard. And I think that's why, like, people who look back at Oregon football of that era, they're like, oh, they could have won it all with Dennis Dixon. And here came Darren Thomas after him. Darren Thomas was not Dennis Dixon. He was not anywhere near as good as Dennis Dixon. But I remember looking back at those Dennis Dixon teams, and I'm like, Dennis Dixon was really one of the first college quarterbacks that I saw that utilized his ability to run and pass and lead and played hard. And, you know, a very different quarterback in that progression of QBs at Oregon that went like Dan Fouts and guys like, you know, Chris Miller and Joey Harrington. Dennis Dixon was different. And I don't know if that was more or less relatable because he was such a good athlete, but played hard, man. All right, we got a great show for you today. Rob Mullins, the Oregon AD, is coming up. He's going to join us at 3:30. Steven, I'm going to break here. Let's do a short segment coming back, and then we'll try to grab Rob Mullins right at 3:30 and have a nice long talk with him. Does that sound good to you?
Sounds great.
All right, let's do it.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
University of Oregon Athletic Director Rob Mullins will be joining me coming up in about 5-6 minutes from now. So we're just going to do a quick segment here. Oregon's got Indiana at Autzen Stadium on Saturday. Later in the show, Trent Walker, the wide receiver at Oregon State, will be joining us in the 4 o'clock hour. I want to get Jim Moore on, the former Seattle PI sports columnist, big-time Mariners fan. He wrote a piece for one of the Seattle papers about his mom. His mom's like 95, 96 years old, and she's a Mariners fan, and she's been waiting for like 48 years for the Mariners to get to the World Series. And, he wrote a great piece. I'd love to get him on. We're efforting Jim Moore to try to pop him on late in the 4 o'clock hour as we talk some Mariners. Mariners will play Game 5 against the Detroit Tigers tomorrow. It'll be right here on 750 The Game if you want to tune in on Friday. 5:08 first pitch, which means the BFT will be preempted. We'll do a two-hour show, 3 to 5, and then we'll go right into the Mariners-Tigers game. We'll lead you right in. But Jim Moore, the go-to guy, Seattle PI columnist, we will get him probably late in the 4 o'clock hour today. That's where I'm trying to slot him. As Trent Walker will be joining us at about 4:20. But Rob Mullins, the Oregon AD, will be coming up. I'm going to ask Mullins about a number of different things, including the potential for expansion at Autzen Stadium. What is the private equity plan with the Big Ten Conference? How is he feeling about Oregon's positioning as a top-tier program? Can he join Dan Lanning in lobbying the schedule makers of the Big Ten and trying to get more favorable kickoff times for the Oregon Ducks? Will they get the Ohio State-Michigan treatment is what I'm asking. I keep saying Pac-12, and I mean Big Ten. I can't get it out of my head. It'll never feel right. In fact, if you were waking up from a coma today, and I told you, hey, Indiana is playing Oregon in a game that is huge, they're both 5-0 in the Big Ten, you would be like, what in the hell are you talking about? In the Big Ten, Indiana? Oregon? Big game? College game day? Yeah, that's all happening. Rob Mullins coming up. Leave it here. You got the BFT statewide.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
It'll be Oregon. It'll be Indiana at Autzen Stadium. Big-time football game. I used to cover Indiana. They didn't play in a lot of big-time football games, but they've got one at Autzen Stadium against the Ducks on Saturday. Should be a lot of fun. Great atmosphere. Here to talk about that and a whole bunch of other stuff, Oregon Athletic Director Rob Mullins is joining us. Indiana, Oregon. How you feeling?
I'm excited. You know, these are big games. Top 10 matchup at Autzen Stadium. I'm glad we're at home.
Yeah, give me an idea of what like a home game versus a road game is in your world, because there's a lot of operations that go into a home game. And how different does it feel for you versus you're getting on a plane later today or a charter later today to go somewhere else?
Yeah, there's a lot more at home games, as you can imagine. You know, we're thinking about that fan experience from the time they leave the garage and till they pull back into that garage. So every step along the way outside the lines, there's a lot going on when you're at home games, traffic, concessions, ticket lines, parking. You know, so every bit of that we're talking about and thinking about at home games. You know, obviously there's a lot less of that on the road.
How would that work, let's just say hypothetically, if you get to host a college football playoff first round game, Do you make all that planning well in advance as this year is unfolding, or is that just kind of on the fly and, you know, everybody knows what to do? How does that work?
It's probably too complicated to do on the fly. So you do some of that planning, and, you know, obviously the CFP, you know, sends you all of their requirements for sponsors and other things. So you have a committee of that preparing in the event that you do have the opportunity to host a home game, which would be a heck of a lot of fun.
Those, can you give us a kind of a ballpark on what those games are worth to the average school? Is, you know, an opening round game, is there a number yet?
I don't know. Yeah, no, I don't think there is. I think the CFP gets most of it back. I know you get a stipend to run the event to make sure that obviously you have everything you need. And then, you know, the majority of the ticket revenue goes back to the CFP. And I think you get a share for, like everybody does in one of those games.
Rob Mullins with us, University of Oregon Athletic Director. There's been a lot of talk about private equity, private capital, the Big Ten working on something. What's your view on that, or what's Oregon's position right now as the Big Ten explores all that?
Well, first, our position is we're very happy to be proud to be members of the Big Ten and to have outstanding leadership in Commissioner Petitti, presidents and chancellors of the 18 institutions, and then my colleagues as ADs. And, you know, the college athletics landscape has shifted significantly over the last few years, and we all are pursuing every opportunity to modernize the operation in every way possible. And I just appreciate the leadership of Tony to make sure that the Big Ten stays at the forefront.
Is it a cautious step that these schools are taking? I'm not just talking about Big Ten or you guys, but in general, as colleges open the door for private capital, how cautious do you have to be? We all know it's a business. These are businesses. There's a lot of money involved. Yeah. But there's still this academic part of the schools and this higher learning thing going on in the background. How cautious do you think schools are going to have to be and conferences have to be?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're student athletes first. And of our 500 student athletes, you know, the majority of them, you know, are going to do everything they can to take advantage of their NIL and to prepare to play professionally, but are likely going to be in a profession other than their sport. But, you know, while we're here, because it has become much more complicated, and you're looking for ways, you know, to modernize the commercialization. So, yeah, you would proceed very cautiously on anything that you're doing new. But probably, you know, equally important is to be very thorough in your review, because you do want to make sure that you can compete. And right now, the game has changed over the last few years. It's largely about resources, and you need the resources, or at least a baseline of resources, to compete at a high level, and that's very difficult.
The baseline of resources that you need, that thing's moved, right? Like, you know, when you got in this business.
Daily.
Yeah. Okay, so daily it's moving. How challenging is that for you? Because you've got a budget, and you're budgeting a moving target.
It's extremely difficult, you know, because, you know, before it was, you know, we had scholarship limits, and if you could provide the maximum allowable scholarships under the NCAA rules, you know, that created somewhat of a playing field. And then you were, you know, investing in coaches' salaries and facilities and student athlete experience with all the extra support, nutrition, mental health, concierge medicine, you name it. And now you have this other element of, you know, you got $20.5 million of internal revenue share, which is a baseline to compete at the top. And then you got to strategically allocate that. But even above that, you know, the new frontier to compete at the highest level is, you know, what infrastructure are you setting in place to help your student athletes, you know, get third party true NIL that passes through the NIL Go system? Because, you know, that's what's going to set you apart.
Rob Mullins with us, Oregon Athletic Director. Okay, you say student athletes. A lot of people say student athletes. I was talking to Dylan Gabriel on this show last year, and I said, oh, you know, this is great. Isn't it great how simple your life is as a college kid? And, you know, when you turn pro next year, it's going to get a lot more complicated. And he says, John, I don't know how to tell you this. He says, we're pros. We're the pros. This is the pros now. These guys are making money. Why is it important to you and others? You're not the only one to call them student athletes still. Is that an old NCAA habit, or is that a mandate? What's going on with that?
No, neither. Nice try, though. Because I still think that's the priority, John. I mean, listen, we're connected to the academic mission. We're a part of the academy. And yes, there will be a handful of student athletes who are high earners now while they're in college. But the majority of student athletes, this will be the highest level they play. And we all know the value of a degree and the experience of being an Oregon student and an Oregon student athlete. So I still think it's an appropriate term.
I am interested in the general manager philosophy. Do you think, and again, it's a moving target because House settlement changed some things here, but should each sport have a GM, or is there a GM over your revenue generating sports that's really important? And then maybe a multitude of other sports have a GM that how do you sort of segment that at Oregon?
So here it's by sport. And while we didn't go create 20 new positions that we titled GM, we had people in those sports, whether on the recruiting side or the team ops side or the coaching side, that added that, because they were already really being the people that were, talent acquisition, if you will. And we supported them with the resources administratively, if they have rev share, on how to execute that, educate on the rules, how to execute that, how to monitor that. And we have lots of tools to do that.
You also, that GM's got to deal with agents, has got to deal with parents, got to deal with teenage kids who all, some of which might think their market value is higher than it really is. And that job is really interesting to me. I give me some Advil before I do that job, but I think it's really, but can you model it after pros, like an NFL general manager? Is that a totally different animal?
I think it's there are some similarities, right? And those people in those roles were already dealing with, the recruiting relationships, the parent relationships, the student-athlete relationships. And over the last few years, now that it's permissible, you can add the agents. Probably the complicating factor for the collegiate part is the transfer portal, right? In pros, you have a draft, you have a set time of free agency, you have no tampering rules that are pretty severe. None of those exist in college athletics. So that's the part that's probably most difficult.
Rob Mullins with us, Oregon Athletic Director. The joy of a victory. You see coaches like Dan Lanning, he was exuberant on the field at Penn State. I saw you down there too. It has to feel really good. What does that feel like when you've invested a lot of your time, effort, and energy, and you're getting a result on the field with a coach that you hired?
Yeah, obviously it's exciting to see, the coaches and student athletes. You've been behind the scenes, John. You know how much they put into this in the off season, in the season, and all that goes into it. So it's fun for me to see them have that joy, especially in a big game, intense moments, and to have that success. It is a lot of fun. And, those post-game locker rooms after wins, of any kind, are a lot of fun, largely because of all that goes into that with the coaches, the staff, and the student athletes. You want them, when there's a good process doesn't always guarantee good result, but when good process has good result, it's a bonus.
All right, you guys are flying. Were you flying out of Happy Valley? You flying out of Harrisburg? Where'd you guys fly out of?
So we flew into State College. Yeah. But had to fly out of Harrisburg because of fuel load. So we bussed back over to Harrisburg to depart.
So the adrenaline as you're leaving, the stadium, you're leaving Beaver Stadium in those buses, I imagine it's not quiet on the bus, that people are still kind of buzzing around a little bit. Like 90 minutes, an hour, how long before everybody kind of settles down or the energy changes?
It was probably, so we, you know, you got all the post game media stuff. Time you get out of there, you're another hour, hour and a half after the game before you're moving. And then the ride to Harrisburg was probably an hour and a half. So I'd say, you know, probably that 2.5 hours. By the time we got to the plane, it probably settled down. But yeah, you're recounting the plays, looking at the scores of other games. There's just a lot of chatter about recapping the game, and there is a ton of energy.
What was your favorite part of that double overtime win?
The end. Having 6 more points than you.
Right. Right. Yeah, but you know what?
It was fun to be on the field and just see, you know, because it, you know, it the way it ended in that big interception, and it, you know, it all happened so fast. And then just to be, to see all the reaction, and you know, there were so many, you were down there, you saw there, yeah. The players had given so much on both sides. You know, players were exhausted. They had left everything on the field. And then just to see the joy after, you know, getting the result.
What I liked about it was, you know, I felt like you guys won the game kind of in regulation, even though you were tied. Then you lost the lead. There was a real moment of resilience there and metal. And then you fall behind in that overtime, and then you come back and tie it, and then you make the play. It just, you know, from, I love narratives, right? And I love watching great stories. It just was, it said a lot about your guys that they just kept playing despite some adverse conditions in that crowd. And, you know, I don't think the crowd was that loud. I think Autzen's louder, but the crowd, visually, it was stunning.
No doubt. And then, you know, you to play that first overtime into the teeth of the student section, which is probably 20 or 25,000 people, was pretty, yeah. And because there was, you know, the amount of action in the last part of the fourth quarter, and then the two overtimes, you know, there's just a lot of drama and a lot of intense moments. And it was fun to see, you know, that our sideline just stay locked in and stay focused. And that's, the, you know, that's part of the culture. That's part of the process that we get to see built here every single day in the off season, during the season. And then to see it play out in those moments when it's most needed is pretty powerful.
I had a sit down with your president, you know, I think it was a year ago or so. And we talked about Autzen, and he's excited because he's, you know, he was at Wisconsin. He was at Wisconsin previously. And we started talking about the size of Autzen Stadium. You and I have talked about this before. You got a little bit of sample size. I don't know what your ticket sales are like for Saturday, but it feels like you could use 5,000 more seats in there, 7,000 more seats, or maybe some upgraded club or suites that you could upsell. It feels like there's some money out there for University of Oregon. Where do you stand on kind of a look at Autzen Stadium and maybe an upgrade or more seats there?
Yeah, well, we love Autzen Stadium. It is a tremendous home field advantage and tremendous experience, and it'll be sold out on Saturday and trending very close to a sold out for the rest of the year. We'll have standing room only in there on Saturday. So it'll be packed. It'll be loud. And that's something we are always studying. You know, we're in the middle of a significant facility project right now. I can see out my window in our new indoor football practice facility. And then once we do get through that, obviously we'll start. We're always thinking about Autzen. But now we have this new $20.5 million line item.
Yeah.
And the financial pressures of what can we do to increase our base, find third-party NIL to support our student athletes. And so, you know, that, you know, the formula has changed a little bit, but we will always, because football generates 80% of the revenue here. Autzen is our economic engine. And obviously we want to make sure that we're staying, you know, at the forefront with our fan experience, in Autzen, particularly as we're having success.
Could you ever imagine a brand new stadium, or would it always be, what could you do to Autzen?
It would always be, what can you do to Autzen? It's a special place. And we want to make sure that we, you know, continue to have that huge home field advantage that it presents to itself. You know, there are some limitations, you know, because of number of parking spaces and traffic, you know, just the road infrastructure. That's one of the things that I thought you captured well. When you look out at Penn State and you just see tailgating forever, the amount of parking in proximity to the stadium is pretty impressive.
You need to buy up all those neighborhoods around Autzen is what you guys need to do and create parking structures, and it just feels like they're like, you know, ideally, do you have a sense of if you had unlimited seats, how many you could sell, you know, for Saturday's game?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's always complicated with that is, you know, obviously we're a top five football program in a top 10 matchup. But you always want to make sure that you have the number that's right, that you're packed and you keep the atmosphere, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think you ever want to overbuild. But when it's rolling, yeah, sure, there probably is some left on the table. But, you know, I think for us, you know, with the road infrastructure, the parking, you know, as we look at it, you know, in delivering the kind of experience that we want to deliver, there may be a few more thousand there, but I don't think it's significant.
Is there, you know, some upgrades? Because I as I go around to some of these stadiums, I do see, you know, there are stadiums around the country that are building up the suites and the clubs, and
yes,
it feels like maybe is that the bigger opportunity or the bigger area that you might explore?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think our real opportunity is in differentiated premium. So we have outstanding suites, you know, 40 on the south side, 10 on the north side. We have an awesome club on the south side. But I think there would be an opportunity to us. You know, you see Lowe's suites, living room suites. You know, you've seen all sorts of new products that have been introduced in the last 10 to 15 years. And I do, we've done some work with Legends in surveying our fan base. And there obviously is a market and some interest in, you know, something that's more than a one seat in the club or a 25 seat suite. You know, there's a lots of opportunities in between there that we probably need to address.
Rob Mullins with us, Oregon Athletic Director. I had Mario Cristobal on Monday, and we talked about, you know, his time at Oregon, and obviously he left for Miami. And I got to thinking about you because it was such a interesting time. It might not have, that might not be the right word for you, but it was an interesting time to kind of watch when, you know, Mark Helfrich is removed. Willie Taggart is hired. Taggart leaves in a year. I want to go back to that time. You're left, you know, Taggart's gone. You're trying to hold a recruiting class together. What made you pick Mario Cristobal at that time? Because now, in hindsight, it looks like he's the bridge to Dan Lanning. You don't get to Lanning without Cristobal.
Yeah, it was an interesting time. That's one way to put it for sure. You know, and the sequence was difficult, right? Because Oregon football had a lot of success in built-in succession plans, and that's exactly what we had. It didn't work out. You know, and that change is difficult because it's not just one position change. You know, you're talking 30 positions that are changed, and that's difficult. And then, you know, I think Willie did set some things in motion for us. And fortunately, we were able to observe Mario and his leadership, you know, on the year with Willie's staff, could see the player connection. I think you're probably aware there were a lot of players that were, you know, that felt Mario should have an opportunity. And we went through the process. He was a candidate, as were a lot of others. But, you know, his passion, the way that he laid out how we needed to build a recruiting infrastructure to get us to where we wanted to be, given his experience in Tuscaloosa, kind of moved the needle for us. And that's what we set out to do.
Yeah, it couldn't have been easy. I mean, because you're in that spot, you look at Cristobal's track record and you go, okay, what can he do with our resources? How important was it just to hold the recruiting class together, just that piece of it?
Yeah, that's always a piece of it. I mean, you got to be careful not to, you know, to overweight that, but that is a piece of it, as is the current roster, and, you know, making sure that you're going to continue to build on the foundation that was laid in that 7-6 season. And we felt that he was the best person to do that, and continue to just, you know, put the right culture in place, put the right infrastructure for the support staff, really the recruiting staff, in place to enable us to climb those national recruiting rankings.
Well, it's going to be fun when you guys play Miami in a playoff game, and it'll be, the storylines will be there. And it'll be a little poetic, too, I think. It'll be a full circle moment for you. Hey, congrats on everything. I'll see you at the stadium on Saturday, and I appreciate you joining us and updating us on things once in a while.
Great. Thanks, John. We'll see you on Saturday.
All right. There's Rob Mullins, the Oregon Athletic Director. Steven, I want to unpack it a little bit. Love the interview. I thought he was really candid there, particularly mid-interview and late in the interview as he's talking about the stadium, Autzen Stadium. They know they need to raise more money. They know they have the engine to raise it in Autzen Stadium. I think once they get through this practice facility, this football facility build out, I think they will pivot towards the expansion or improvement of Autzen Stadium. I wouldn't be surprised to see another 1,000 or two seats added and a particular emphasis on club and suite and, as he put it, the differentiation of those suite levels. Everybody wants to have the VIP section. I think they're going to have multiple tiers of VIP seats at Autzen one day.
Yeah, and I mean, that's been the question for years, is like, how big can you actually make Autzen Stadium without having it lose its, I can't think of the word, but it's, just the love that they have and the feeling that you get going to Autzen Stadium, that it's not like the big house. It's not like just one of these commercialized stadiums. How big can you make it and not lose it? But I think you and Ron Mullins are kind of right. Like, in these big-time games, I mean, you could sell so many more tickets to this game and make so much more money and make it that much more intimidating. And we just saw how Penn State, how they do it up close with Oregon against them. It's like, man, Oregon have that same type of thing. And they're up in that caliber of blue blood now. So you got to think about it, all options now.
The question is, how big is too big? And you don't want to add so many seats that you sort of you create a further congestion problem around Autzen Stadium. It's not the easiest stadium to get in and out of on game day to begin with. So, I would say you can't add too many seats, but you also want to keep sort of the novelty of tickets being in demand. Leave it here. Get the BFT.
BFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
I got a whole bunch of football games, college football games, NFL games, including tonight's Thursday night football. We've got the Mariners and Tigers tomorrow in a pivotal Game 5 of the American League Division Series. Mariners win. They'll advance to the ALCS. Game 1 for that would be Sunday. Game 2, Monday. So we'll see how that happens, how that unfolds for the Mariners. You can only watch one sporting event, Steven, between now and Sunday night. Only one. What are you watching?
I'm going to watch the Mariners-Tigers. Game 5. It's between that and Oregon, Indiana, but since it's a playoff game, it's Game 5, that trumps it. The defaults me to that game.
Yeah, because if Oregon beats Indiana or loses to Indiana, it changes the trajectory, sure. But Oregon doesn't play Ohio State. Oregon doesn't play Michigan. Oregon's just got to beat Iowa and Wisconsin and USC and Washington and, that Oregon team could still get into the Big Ten championship game.
Right. And the thing that makes me so intrigued about this Oregon game, John, though, is the way Penn State played the next week against UCLA and got absolutely hammered defensively. It does make me question, like, should I downgrade that win a little bit? Like, is Penn State not as good as we thought they were? And Oregon maybe is not as good as we think they are? Now, is Indiana better than Penn State? Like, is this the matchup we should have been highlighting? That's why this game is so intriguing to me.
It does hold some intrigue. You sound like Heather Dinich of ESPN. Hmm. We'll play her clip as part of Punch It Audio. Let's do it.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald-Faced Truth Headquarters.
Hey, we're all about truth, justice, and the American way here, okay? Which is why we've spanned the globe and pulled the top audio cuts of the day.
You're going to hear little snippets of sound.
Hey, it's time for Punch It Audio.
Presented by First Call Heating and Cooling.
Let's start with Heather Dinich, ESPN. She says this Oregon game comes with questions. Ducks, Hoosiers, Saturday, 12:30, Autzen Stadium.
Honestly, I'm more curious about Oregon because after what we've seen happen to Penn State, I'm wondering how good of a win that was, to be honest. Yeah. And of course, you know, you've got two fantastic quarterbacks in Dante Moore and Indiana's Fernando Mendoza. Both of them will have a chance to make a statement in terms of the Heisman race. But the reality is that this, you know, the loser of this game isn't out of the college football playoff. But when we talk about games like this, we're talking about the Big Ten conference standings, which are very critical because the five highest ranked conference champs get a lock in a spot in the college football playoff. We're also talking about seeding. Remember, you don't have to be a conference champion this year to get one of the top four seeds and a first round bye. Games like this can impact that as far as the head-to-head results.
We're not talking like this in the NFL. We don't talk like this in the NFL. And I wonder why people are still thinking like this in college football. The object of the game is to win the championship. I'm not sure having a first-round bye is a best-case scenario for any team. I'm not sure. I'm just not sure. And I feel like that should be the conversation right now. Would it actually benefit Oregon to lose this game close to Indiana and then regroup and come back and play like gangbusters as the five seed instead of, you know, we don't know. And I don't yet know if last year, was it the layoff or was it the fact that maybe just Ohio State was that good and humming along and they would have beat everybody. I do have questions about Oregon. I think the Ducks win against Penn State on Saturday. I don't think it's a blowout win, but I think Oregon wins and proves that it's the better team.
The thing that I'm starting to lean Indiana plus the points. I think Oregon wins, but I'm going to take the points. Kurt Cignetti, I think, does have the coaching advantage over Dan Lanning. And I love Dan Lanning. But, you know, going against James Franklin's one thing. Going against Kurt Cignetti is another thing. And I think that he'll have his team ready, have some type of game plan. I think that rushing game is going to be big for Indiana. Can they get after Dante Moore? They've done it all season long. Indiana's defense has. I think they'll have something for Oregon that maybe they're not quite ready for. And that way, the reason I do like Indiana plus the points.
The shine is off Texas football. Steve Sarkisian unranked this week. Stephen A. Smith going after him.
I'm very disappointed with what I've seen from Steve Sarkisian this year. To me, Paul, he has coached scared. He has coached like somebody who's been forced to deal with all the allure, all the attention and notoriety that comes associated with Arch Manning. And he has not lived up to the billing any more than his quarterback has. And I think that he's been feeling the pressure since the opening of the season.
I think it's Sark. This is what Sark does, though, isn't he? Like, I haven't seen Sark take a team, take a program, take a roster, and overachieve anywhere at Washington, at USC, not at Texas. This is kind of who Sark is. When he has the better players and the better team, you kind of like him. But I'm not sure, like in the case of Penn State, in the case of Texas, are they going to be casualties of this era where we're seeing more and more parity? And oh, by the way, the things that can separate you are either you have better talent or you can really coach, and I don't know if Sark can really coach.
I think Arch Manning stinks, and I think Sark is doing the best that he can. Last year, we all kind of called for Arch Manning to play over Quinn Ewers. Sark was at no way, and for me, that actually gives Sark some credit that he stayed away from that because Quinn Ewers is obviously better than Arch Manning. John, honestly, Arch Manning looks like he's a Mountain West quarterback. He looks like he should be playing at Rice, not at Texas.
Joel Klatt says this is a big game. USC is hosting Michigan at the Coliseum. Big game for Lincoln Riley.
This game is, I think, a game that could end up being the best game of the weekend because styles make fights, and this is a great clash of styles and philosophies and identities. You've got one team that's going to lean into the physical aspect of the game in Michigan and another team that has really struggled in that aspect, and USC has not dealt well with the physicality of the Big Ten, and so they're going to lean into the skill and being able to throw the football. Lincoln Riley is desperate for a win in a game like this. They've got to go to Notre Dame still. They still have Oregon. That schedule is very difficult. So if you lose this, you're staring at 8-4. But if you win this football game, now all of a sudden you're like, well, hold on. Can we get to 10-2? Can we steal a game against Notre Dame? Can we steal a game against Oregon? Can we get ourselves into the playoff race? So certainly not over for USC and a matchup which they would feel like they could probably throw the ball.
Sharon Moore, the Michigan coach, saying that the reason the Coliseum is sold out is because Michigan's coming to town. Lincoln Riley asked about it, said, I don't care what he thinks. These are the kinds of games that Lincoln Riley and USC have historically lost. These are the kind of games where they have wilted. I think this is a very important game for Lincoln Riley. I don't agree with Joel Klatt. I don't think it's going to be the game of the weekend. I think the game of the weekend is Utah-Arizona State. I think that one is going to be 31-30, 28-27. That late game, that's going to be a great late game on Saturday. I don't think USC-Michigan is going to wow like people, like Klatt thinks it is. But a very important game for Lincoln Riley, because if he loses that game, particularly how he loses, it starts the narrative on the beginning of the end, really, of Lincoln Riley. If he wins that game, it buys him some time. This John Mateer thumb thing has become unbelievable. You can't make it up. Michael Thompson on OU Nightly giving a news report on John Mateer's thumb. Is he going to play? Texas-Oklahoma plan. Will Mateer go?
Is OU trying to hide John Mateer? Brent Venables says they're inside because they finally received air conditioning in their practice facility and added this.
Practicing in 71-degree weather is a little different than 90 degrees.
I love you, BV. That's some bull you just said.
It's not hot right now, so I don't know what he's talking about there.
Clearly, students don't buy it. One being Cooper Whitaker, the viral tortilla presser who did his own reporting when he found himself face-to-face with Mateer while working at Chipotle.
Kind of try to keep it composed, but then I was like immediately like, so how's the thumb? you know, and then I was like, are you playing for OU Texas? And he's like, yeah, definitely. And then I was like super geeked, you know, like the whole conversation after that. He showed me his thumb. It was only stitches, no cast. He said the doctor shouldn't put three nails in there. So he's all good.
While Venable says one thing, Whitaker says this.
BV has been very careful with his words recently. He's been like, we assume he's not playing. We say these things. He's like, oh, you know, he's like trying hard. But what Mateer told me is that he definitely wants to play.
The tortilla presser's reporting might not be credible, but this take is.
I don't hate a lot of things, being a Christian and all, but Texas is from Satan.
Well, that take might be questionable, but so could John Mateer when the injury report comes out later tonight at 7 o'clock. Reporting from campus, Michael Thompson, OU Nightly.
This reminds me of Ferris Bueller's day off when they were like, did you hear Ferris needs a new kidney? Like, you know.
How about the Chipotle guy getting the scoop, though?
He scooped him.
Well, and this goes to Pete Thamel. Pete Thamel just tweeted this 45 minutes ago, John. Oklahoma quarterback John Mateer is in line to attempt to play against Texas on Saturday. His injured right thumb will be monitored, and there's no certainty he'll be able to go. He's listed as questionable. So you literally said nothing. The Chipotle guy knows more than Pete Thamel does.
What are we talking about, though? Read Thamel's report. Like, that's a nothing burger. Come on, Pete. Pete and I are friends, but come on. That's not news.
I'm all in on this Chipotle guy.
Get to Chipotle. Pivoting. Ryan Clark says Shedeur Sanders in Cleveland, if he's not the backup, it's time to part ways. What does he mean?
If he is not named the backup quarterback, it's time to part ways. It's time to trade him. It's time to get him out of your locker room, because clearly your plan for development is not to develop Shedeur Sanders as a future starter of your team, and too much comes with him if you don't see that sort of plan for him.
Look, I would get him out of the locker room too, but my reason for getting him out of the locker room is he's been a raging distraction. You know, and if you're not going to play, I mean, if you're not going to have him as the backup, why do you have him in the room? Meanwhile, Shedeur, changing his tune a little bit, says he's happy for his teammates like Dylan Gabriel. He loves to see guys go be successful. Here's Shedeur. He's talking.
Say anytime players, you know, that I came in with and that I spent a lot of time with, they get moved up and they're able to have a vital role in this offense and this piece, I get extremely excited for, and I'm playing through them. You know what I mean? I'm excited just as them every time they get out there and run around and everything, because it's just amazing that, you know, you start somewhere and then you're able to evolve and get to a different level, and go out there and actually be able to execute it. Just like Dylan, like whenever he got moved up to QB1, I'm like, you know, that's lit, bro. You got to make sure you handle everything the right way and, you know, just continue being him. So, like for me, overall, I'm just happy. I'm excited that everybody is living their dreams, you know, and I'm living my dream also. Come every day and be able to work.
Look, he's living his dream. He's happy that his teammates living his dream. You believe him, Steven? Is he happy? Is he happy for Dylan Gabriel?
Yeah, I think he's happy. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt on that one. I like the way what he said he came out. That's all he has to say, and a lot of this will go away. It's just the looks that he makes and stuff like that. But to go out and say, look, I like my guys. I like my teammates. I love that Shador came out and said that. And to Ryan Clark's thing, John, they aren't developing Shador Sanders to be the franchise quarterback. They're doing that with Dylan Gabriel. So, yes, if you really think that's the case, they need to get rid of Shador because they believe more in Dylan Gabriel than they do Shador. I mean, I think they've made that pretty obvious.
I think if you just live by the mantra, be normal, that will take you a long way. You know, ask yourself as you're about to create a scene at Costco, is this a normal thing that I'm about to do? Ask yourself as you're in your interactions with coworkers, can you act normal? If you're in a movie theater and you're doing something abnormal, you're talking during the previews, be normal. Shador Sanders, just be normal. Don't you know, he was miming. Last week he was miming, now he's talking. Just continue to talk. I like you better when you talk. Baseball. Monster home run. Here's how it sounded, Kyle Schwarber.
This has been a major story. Uh-oh, Schwarber gonna send one way out of here. How far will it fly? My goodness. Kyle Schwarber with a tape measure shot up on top of the pavilion and right. That is one of the biggest bombs you will ever see.
Big bomb, 455 feet. One swing, fourth inning, Phillies 8-2 win.
Almost out of Dodger Stadium.
Man. Ball left the bat at 117.2 miles an hour.
Jeez.
Almost got over the right field seats at Dodger Stadium. It's ridiculous. Schwarber said, when I hit it, I knew it was a home run. Said he didn't see where it landed. He just looked to the dugout and tried to get guys going.
Your eyes don't see that far.
I had to pull out my glasses to see how far that went.
The telescope to go find that one.
Phillies, Dodgers. That was a must-win situation, too. So, big bomb when his team needed it. Right now, they're in the top of the fifth. Dodgers leading that series 2-1. Top of the fifth, 0-0 in game four. So, somebody looking for a little momentum. Phillies, even that up, maybe. Mariners will be taking on the Detroit Tigers in an elimination game that will bring tears to the eyes in people in Seattle one way or another. A friend of mine who goes to Mariners games and usually pays somewhere between $10 and $20 to sit in the outfield says that he looked ahead at the World Series tickets, Stephen, and that same seat for a potential World Series game in Seattle is listed at $850.
Wow. Wow.
So, a lot of excitement in Seattle. Finally, Dana Altman says he still loves to coach. He loves basketball. Big Ten Media Day.
I love coaching. I love going to the gym. Games are torture, but practice is a lot of fun. I enjoy being around the guys. My grandson, Carter, enjoys it. And I love coaching. I always have. Been really fortunate. Been at really good schools, Kansas State, Creighton, and now at Oregon. You know, I've been luckier than most.
Dana Altman, good coach. I wondered in the last couple of years how much fun he was having. You know, you kind of look at him on the sideline, you look at where the game is going, you look at everything that's happening in college sports, and you kind of go, okay, is this person still enjoying themselves? Big part of that, certainly in the victories that you get. But the job, like he talked about this on the show, like, you know, he's not a young guy and he's facing a moving target. And I can tell you this, like I have been in my business in sports media for long enough to see several changes. I've seen, you know, social media become a thing. And I remember older sports writers on Press Row going, I'm not going to get on Twitter. I'm not going to get on TikTok or Instagram. You better be on there. If you want to reach the audience, you got to go where the audience is. And Dan Altman, he's made enough changes and he has enough infrastructure at Oregon. They're smart enough to kind of steer him in the ways that they need to steer him. And he's getting young players. Trevor Ariza's kid is now committed to Oregon in class of 2026. So I think Altman, you know, still loves coaching, still loves the game of basketball. He doesn't love the other stuff. But if Oregon can get some people on his staff to do the other stuff, they can bridge Altman to, you know, the next three or four seasons and then figure out what they want to do. Coming up, we're going to visit with Oregon State wide receiver Trent Walker. The Beavers are looking for a win. Wake Forest is coming to town. Leave it here. You got the BFT statewide.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Every Thursday, Trent Walker, star wide receiver, Oregon State, is kind enough to join us on this radio show, courtesy of Jamba. Life is better blended. That's what Jamba tells you. I was in Jamba the other day. I got a razzmatazz, Trent Walker. I got one of those orange creamsicle or dreamsicles. I can't remember what it's called, but I brought them home for the kids. They loved them. How you doing, man?
I'm good, man. I appreciate you having me on. I've had the razzmatazz as well. That was pretty good.
All right, so if they ask you for the boost, do you go with the protein? Do you go with vitamin, immunity? What do you use for a boost?
I usually put the zinc, the vitamins, okay. Just to keep me healthy.
I like that. Yeah, how's your body feel this time of year? I mean, you've got a lot of yards, a lot of catches. How are you physically?
Yeah, it's week seven. I think my body feels like it's week seven, but, you know... Our trainers do a great job of getting us right. I'm a big believer in movement is medicine, motion is lotion. So getting up and moving around, stretching is the best thing for me.
I love that. I love that. Movement is medicine, motion is lotion. You can put that. You need to brand that, man. Trent Walker is with us. All right, you got Wake Forest. They're traveling across the country. This is not a conference game for them. I wonder how many of them know anything about Oregon State beyond your record. Maybe their quarterback does because he played at Oregon. But give us an idea. What do you see Wake Forest on film?
Wake Forest, yeah, they're a talented group. I think they're similar to Houston in terms of physicality on the defense side of ball. But we got them at home at Reser. I think anytime we're at home at Reser, we feel better about it. We don't have to get on a plane and travel for 8 hours like we did last week. So, I mean, yeah, we're ready for it. I'm hoping that research turns out with the students being here and all. It was a great turnout with the student section last week, or last home game, so I'm hoping it's the same thing.
The psychological toll, we've talked about this. I don't want to get stuck on this stuff, but it is a question every week. You know, how do you stay motivated? How do you stay engaged when you're not getting a result? What do you say to that when people ask you that question? You know, where are you guys psychologically right now?
Yeah, I mean, last game definitely hurt. That was probably one of the ones that hurt the most because we felt like we were a better team and we didn't execute at the beginning. We started off flat. And then the 8-hour travel coming back home never helps. But I think a lot of guys in our locker room have just fallen in love with the process. When you're not, obviously the outcome and the record isn't what we expected nor want. But when you fall in love with the process and you love the game, you don't really need outside people to give you motivation. It kind of comes within.
It would be nice to get a win though, because that I know, you know, as an athlete, that has to be sort of the reward at the end of it. And, you know, process is important, but how important is it for you guys psychologically to get something to show for your efforts sooner rather than later?
Yeah, no, trust me when I say we want to win more than you guys and more of the fans want us to win. Winning it, I don't want to say it's everything, but it feels like it's everything. We just got to get going. Get some momentum on our side and then just go on a run.
Wake Forest coming to Reser Stadium 12:30 on Saturday. We're talking to Trent Walker, Oregon State wide receiver. You know, I saw a stat. If you go back, like in the last year, you've got more yards, more catches, you know, more more activity as a wide receiver than anybody in the country. How does that feel to you, being a guy who was a walk-on, who wasn't highly recruited? When you look at that and you hear that, you know, one of the greats at Oregon State, but nationally as well, statistically, you're at the top of that.
Yeah, I had no idea until our media team made that little graphic for me. I don't really look at the stats. I think I'm just trying to do my part. And the biggest thing for me was, like, I was in the room with some real talented guys, and Anthony Gould, Silas Bolden, Trayvon Bradford, those kind of guys. So every day I went about my business on the practice field, I was trying to be better than them, better than how I saw them when they were here. And I think that's just like the self-motivation that I was talking about. Every day I'm just trying to be the best version of myself and help the team out any way I can. And the results have been nice statistically, but again, I would rather win than be sitting at the top in statistics.
When you're asked the question, who you play for, who you're playing for right now?
I'm playing for my family and then a little bit of myself. My parents went out to App State and they made a little vacation out of it. They've been doing that for the away games, and I think that's just cool for me to give them the opportunity and a reason to go travel around the country. And I say for myself because everyone knows this was my dream to play at Oregon State. I always wanted to like be somebody that Oregon State remembers. So yeah, just a little bit of both.
The story of you being a kid going to games at Reister Stadium, now starring for your team. You know, I asked your coach Trent Bray. I said, you know, who's an unsung hero in this team? And you know, he said, a guy who's doing a great job this season. And he said, obviously Trent Walker. But then he started talking about some of the guys on the offensive line. When I say unsung hero, who popped into your mind on your team?
I think it goes straight to the O line and some guys in the receiver room that haven't been getting as much love as I think they deserve. And Taz Reddick and Eddie Freehoff. I mean, Eddie's a freshman and he's doing great things so early. It's pretty cool to see. And then Taz, anytime he gets his number called, he's going out there and producing. I think a lot of guys in the receiver room are ready to be in the spotlight. I think we have a real talented and deep room.
What's it going to take? You know, and I know that might seem like a silly question, but you know, you guys probably focus on a lot of little things every day in practice and hope that they equate to big things on game day. But is there a way to simplify football where you say, okay, this is what we need to do to be successful? And what is that thing?
The message that Bray has given us, and I couldn't agree more, is 11 guys on each side of the ball doing their job and their job to the best of their ability. When dudes try to do too much or aren't communicating, and that's when things go south. So I think in the simplest form, you win football games by being the best version of yourself and trusting that the guy next to you is doing the right thing and then being the best version of himself.
Yeah, you talk about the try to do too much thing. I think you see that, right? When maybe things weren't going well on the special teams front early in the game, early in the season, you could see the coaching staff going, okay, we're not kicking a field goal on fourth down, and you suddenly have, you know, you're doing things that are a little unorthodox. How do you keep from, you know, being a guy who's been highly productive, how do you keep from trying to do too much and staying within yourself and playing your game?
That just goes back to like what I was saying about the receiver room. I have full confidence in the guys that line up with me. I think at any point those dudes can go out and make huge plays for us. Just knowing and trusting that allows me to just do my job on a given play. And I don't always have to be where the ball is because I know these guys are more than capable of doing it.
I have to think the defense, though, pre-snap is yelling, watch seven here, watch seven. Where, you know, they know, they've scouted, they've watched you. How are you still getting the ball despite the fact that everybody knows you're getting the ball?
I think that's all in Gundy and my receiver coach. They do a good job of moving me around whenever they can. When they put me in the slot, it's a little bit harder to like put their number one guy on me, because usually the best cover guy is a DB who's covering someone on the outside. So I think Coach Gundy and Coach Pat, they do a good job of finding ways to get me the rock.
School has obviously started. Students are back. What's your favorite class that you're enrolled in right now?
My favorite class right now is probably the history of music and film, because I'm taking it with a couple of my buddies, and it's not the most difficult in the world.
So give us an idea of what that's like. Tell us one thing you've learned, or maybe something you guys have focused on in one of those early classes.
The big emphasis on week one is how music in a film like dictates how an audience feels about what is being shown.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something I never really thought of. Like when you watch a movie or whatever, like you're not thinking of the background pianist or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, if we put a little piano, soft piano music to this interview, it's a different interview, right? We put a little Raiders 100%. Of the Lost Ark, and suddenly the action picks up, and there's a little more intense and a little more suspense. I hope the background music on Saturday is lively for you guys. I would love to see you get a W, and we could talk about it next week. Trent Walker, good luck to you, man. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, appreciate you always having me on, man.
You bet. All right, thanks, Trent. We'll catch you next week.
Okay.
All right. There he goes. Trent Walker, wide receiver, Oregon State. They're due. Should have won the Fresno State game. Should have won the Houston game. Should have won the Appalachian State game. They should be 3-3. 2-4, worst case scenario. They are 0-6. It is a difficult thing to deal with working and working and working and getting no reward. Or working and working, working and getting punched in the gut. Whatever metaphor you want to use for Oregon State, they haven't had the success. And I think it's been difficult and trying for the players on this team, the coaches on this team, but I'll tell you what, I feel for the players. They have played well. I think coaching's been a problem. I'm eager to see the special teams units play on Saturday. Are they the best special teams team in America on Saturday? They should be. Everything should be locked down. Everything should be crisp. Everything, you know, if there are problems, it shouldn't be there. I am left looking at Wake, traveling across the country, coming all that way to Corvallis for a non-conference game against an 0-6 team. Jake Dickard's team's a little bit in transition. Yes, they're not bad. I think Oregon State's got a shot in this game. They are a 3-point dog at home to Wake Forest. I think they'll be in it. See if they can figure out a way to close out a game. I want you to leave it here. You got the bald-faced truth. We're going to go to Jim Moore, the go-to guy coming up. Mariners in a winner-take-all game 5 against the Tigers tomorrow. How are people in Seattle feeling about it? Well, we check with one. Leave it here.
Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Absolutely love baseball. I love this time of year. It's October. Yes, we have college football. But, man, we've got baseball and everybody jockeying for the World Series. Last night on the Fox baseball broadcast running up to Game 4 of the Mariners and Tigers, Derek Jeter was asked about the urgency that the Mariners had in trying to close out the series in 4 games and avoid having to go back to Seattle for a Game 5. Here's what Derek Jeter said.
No, there's no urgency. You know, if you lose this game, you just go back home and you play in front of your home crowd for game 5.
Mm-hmm.
No, absolutely. This is a must-win situation for the Seattle Mariners. That's how they have to approach it. Look, I know they enjoy playing at home. Everyone in Seattle wants to see another home game. The players want to go back there and play. But if you lose today, your reward is Tarik Skubal in game 5. And you should not bank on facing him because he's ready.
They're talking last night on the broadcast, that's Derek Jeter speaking there on the Fox broadcast, about the task that the Mariners have set up. Now, we all know that the Mariners went on to lose that game, and there is a Game 5. It is back in Seattle. It'll be Tarik Skubal. For the fourth time this season, can the Mariners beat him? Can they beat the Cy Young winner for the fourth time? Jim Moore, the go-to guy who I read religiously, had a great column today as he talked about that task that the Mariners are facing. And the go-to guy, Jim Moore, former columnist at the Seattle PI, joining us now. How you doing, Jim?
Good, John. How are you?
Jim, how you feeling about this pivotal Game 5 in this ALDS series? How are you feeling about it?
Well, I mean, I know most Mariner fans are thinking, oh, my God, we got to face Tarik Skubal, and we've beaten him three times, and there's no way they're going to be able to beat him a fourth time. But, John, I'm usually pessimistic, glass-half-empty guy, but I'm going to bet $100 on the Mariners. That's how I feel about it. So I just think that they're an underdog, but they're at home. It's going to be crazy there at T-Mobile Park, and I just think they're going to get it done. I just think it's – for whatever reason, the Mariners seem to have this guy's number, and I think it might be in his head a little bit when he takes the mound on Friday.
Yeah, and I think people say, oh, how hard is it to beat a guy four times? I would rather be the team that beat him three times than be that pitcher out there in the mound going, why can't I get these guys out like I get everybody else out? What do you think the secret for the Mariners has been in hitting him as well as they've hit him?
You know, I'm not really sure, but I saw that Ryan Roland Smith, who's a former Mariner, who's a part of the Root Sports broadcast team, he mentioned something about them laying off his changeup. And changeup is Skubal's out pitch, and it seems to be pretty effective for them, whatever they're doing. But, and it's not, you know, his ERA is 4.68 against the Mariners in three starts this year, and he only gave up two runs, the Polanco home runs. Mm. In the playoff game on Sunday. So it's not like he's getting lit up or anything, but he's getting lit up enough where you feel like, hey, man, maybe we've got a chance again facing him, even though the odds would certainly seem to favor a guy that's going to win the Cy Young Award and whose ERA was 2.21 this year.
The management of Dan Wilson, you know, he pulls his starter after at 55 pitches for a matchup situation. I heard from some Mariner fans who said, hey, he's getting too cute here. Let these guys play. What have you made of Wilson in this postseason?
Well, he's learning on the fly, and I think he's overmatched with AJ Hinch in the other dugout, but he's doing the best he can. I got a kick out of it the other day when they asked him about the chess match that was going on with AJ Hinch, and he said that he'd never played chess, so he doesn't know what you're talking about, basically. I'm thinking, well, geez, I guess the Mariner manager's playing checkers. What the hell?
I love
but
that.
But I just think, yeah, I just think the Mariners, you know, with Dan Wilson, I think he's doing the best job that he can. Now, he learned in game one that he shouldn't have George Kirby face, God, I'm drawing a blank, Carpenter. Yeah. He shouldn't face Carpenter. And yet he left him in there, and Carpenter had the 2-run home run that was a game deciding blow. And so in the next game, though, he took Castillo out, brought Spire in, and it worked out. So, yeah, I think it's the Tigers have an advantage over Wilson, but Wilson, I think, is doing a fairly good job with matching up with Hinch along the way here.
Give me an idea, because you were immersed in it for years, writing columns there in Seattle. You are, you know, you've followed the Mariners and you know what fans have been through. What would it mean for Mariners fans to get a win in Game 5, get to the ALCS, have a shot at a World Series?
Well, it would mean everything, John. There've just been long suffering Mariner fans, and a couple of weeks ago I wrote a column for the News Tribune in Tacoma, and I interviewed my own mom, and I normally wouldn't do something like that, but I thought that she was a good example of someone who's been waiting and waiting and waiting. And she's 96 years old, and this team got to town in 1977. And so however many years that is, what is that? I mean, 48, 49 years, where it's the only team in Major League Baseball that's never been to a World Series. And they've always been known as a losing franchise, and no one pays attention to them up in Seattle. And it would just, you know, they showed a guy crying the other day when there was a big hit by Julio in game two. And I think there's going to be a lot of tears in Seattle. God, I might even cry. I mean, I was, what was I, 19 years old when the Mariners got to town. And I went through the Seattle Pilots in 69 coming to town. I was like, oh, my God, I'm 12 years old. And Major League Baseball's here in Seattle. And they took him away and went to Milwaukee after 1 year. And so there's been a lot of heartache and gut-wrenching losses over the years. And Jesus, I'm a Kook fan too. So I feel like I'm owed one by the sports gods. And I think a lot of people feel like, come on, man, can this finally be the year for the Seattle Mariners to make it to a World Series? And so we all figured it would be hard and it wasn't going to be easy to get there. And so why not a game five and take out the Cy Young Award winner again?
I love it, Jim. I appreciate you joining us. So you're saying you got a hundy on the Mariners on the money line. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. Yes,
all right. I love it.
I'll probably even go more than that. I'll probably parlay them with the Cougs to beat Ole Miss, too. How about that?
I wonder what that odds. What is that? What does that pay, that parlay? That. All right. Hey, I appreciate you joining us, Jim. Thank you, man.
Okay, John. Thanks, man.
I love that. I love the idea of his mother. He's writing about his mother, tortured Mariners fan. Come on. It brings us really full circle on this Mariners conversation, doesn't it? Because it seems like an insurmountable task to win a series in advance, right? But if you simplify it, part of the task, it really isn't just getting back home, but it's sort of the idea that, you know, you have this run of three games that you've had against the Cy Young winner where, you know, his normal ERA, 2.21 this year, is more than double that. The Mariners have averaged 4.68. That's his ERA against the Mariners in three games this season. And it's not like they've had to score a ton of runs off him to prevail because they got the pitching, but his 2.21 ERA is 4.68 against the Mariners. And everybody's saying, well, how hard is that to do, you know, four times against a great pitcher? That may be true. But I also believe in the old adage, the old gambling adage, the trend is your friend. And if I'm Tarek Skubal, I'm looking at the Mariners going, what do they have on me? Why, you know, and I think part of the issue with him is any pitcher will tell you that when they know that they need to hold the opposition to one run or two runs or three runs, it's a much different job and a much different task. And I wonder if part of the issue with Skubal is that the Mariners pitching staff has done a really, you know, prior to last night in the late innings, had done a really nice job against the Tigers all season long. And I think it puts an additional amount of pressure on a pitcher like Skubal to come out and be perfect and make every perfect pitch and know he doesn't have much margin for error. The strength of this Mariners team has been pitching all year long, all last year, and suddenly now you're getting the bats that are starting to come alive. You've had some guys who haven't been hitting home runs in the postseason, suddenly hitting home runs. Of course, you got Cal Raleigh. Of course, you're trying to get Julio Rodriguez going. But I'm looking at the Mariners in a fourth opportunity. I'm not looking at this as like, oh, how hard? What is the probability of beating somebody four times in a row? I'm not asking ChatGPT that. I'm looking at Skubal and I'm going, that guy has to be in his own head right now thinking, what is it about the Mariners that I can't beat the Mariners, or I'm not as good and I'm not the same against the Mariners? And if you're the Seattle Mariners, you are saying, look, we got this game at home. We need to get into the Detroit bullpen. We need a good pitching performance and play good defense behind our starter. But you don't have to be perfect against Skubal. And, you know, and you don't have to be, you don't have to win a 2-1 game. You know, you've got, you know, Polanco hit a couple of home runs last Sunday against Skubal, and, you know, the Mariners rallied against the bullpen to win 3-2. I don't know if it's going to be that kind of game, but I can tell you this, one game winner take all. I'm not saying throw the records out. I'm just saying, gosh, it feels really good if you're a Seattle Mariners fan that you have had some success against this guy that nobody else has had success against. And, you know, look, I'm not a Mariners fan. I'm not scarred by sort of the history of the Mariners organization. I'm not haunted by, you know, the near misses and the exits, but I am looking over at the Detroit Tigers. And I'm thinking, if I'm a Tigers fan, think about how they went out against the Guardians in this same round a year ago. And everybody talked for a year. Can they not break through in the ALDS? Can they not get out of that round? And here they are again, facing a game five. And they have to go on the road to win it. And yeah, they probably feel good about the pitcher that they're throwing out there, but they can't feel all that good. The guys on the Fox broadcast continued. Here's A-Rod sort of parroting what Derek Jeter said. Here's A-Rod last night on the Fox broadcast.
Yeah, look, I mean, this is 100% a must-win situation, and you got to keep the momentum up. The Blue Jays had an opportunity to deliver the knockout punch last night to the Yankees. Mm. They didn't. If the Mariners don't, their reward is they fly 2,000 miles west to face the Cy Young winner, and chances are, Kevin, that the Mariners are not beating Skubal four times in one year.
I just find it interesting. A-Rod, like, literally parroting what Derek Jeter said. Your reward is you're flying across the country, you're facing this guy, and it's a must-win situation. Then the example he brings out is that the Blue Jays don't get it done and then have to come back, and they actually do get it done in the final game against the Yankees, knocking the Yankees out in four. So, I just go back to winners win because they do. The Mariners are in a great situation. If you had told Mariners fans at the beginning of the year, hey, you're going to be in a Game 5 at home in Seattle against a pitcher that you'd already defeated three times during the season, Mariners fans would have lined up to take those odds. They would have lined up to take that opportunity and get that. But, man, isn't this fun? Isn't it the kind of day or the kind of week that reminds you of how great baseball is this time of year? October baseball, the city of Portland, the Portland Diamond Project trying to get baseball into Portland. I think it would just be such a amazing thing if Portland had a dog in the fight, so to speak, and it wasn't just a Seattle team. But there's so many of our listeners who have grown up on the Mariners who are frustrated with Dan Wilson's managing and in Game 4 and thought that the Mariners were playing not to lose. And certainly he was concerned, it looked like, with his bullpen and trying to game it for a Game 5 win. But we'll see how smart or how dumb Wilson looks by virtue of this game and this Game 5 stage that we're going to see. Cal Raleigh and the Mariners taking on the Tigers. When a winner take all, the winner goes to the American League Championship Series. And certainly a lot of Mariners fans, I think, excited about the possibilities. If you are the Mariners, ideally, yeah, you would have loved to win the thing in four and not have to come back home and face the best pitcher in baseball in a winner-take-all game. But for baseball fans who are looking at this, you've got Milwaukee and Chicago and Philadelphia and the Dodgers fighting it out, and you're in this thing. If you're a Seattle fan, that has to feel really good to you. And I think it has to feel great to Mariners fans to be so relevant and engaged. And again, I'll come back to the Portland Diamond Project. Take me out to the ballpark. Get that thing built, because I would love families in Portland and the state of Oregon to participate in postseason baseball, and the hope and the journey of a season and the way that the Mariners fans have been through this with their team. And certainly I think there's angst. I can feel the hand wringing. I can feel the Mariners fans anxious about, hey, is this it? Will the magic of Cal Raleigh and this Mariners season and 60 home runs and all of the hope that this was finally the team that's going to break through and get to World Series, I can feel you fighting against all of that logic and reason that's in your head. Because why? Because you've been through it as a Mariners fan. But I'm here to tell you, this journey is a beautiful thing. Enjoy it, because tomorrow you'll get the Mariners and the Tigers, 5:08 first pitch. We'll have it right here on 750 The Game, and I think it'll be a pretty magical night, and obviously a night that will have a lot of Mariners fans on the edges of their sofas watching. And if you're going to the game, good for you, but this is what you hoped for. This is what you wanted as a Mariner fan. Don't dread it once it's here. Embrace it. Lean into it. All right, coming up, we've got the 5 at 5. We got the 5 biggest stories in sports. Steven has been working on this all day. You got the bald-faced truth statewide on the BFT Radio Network.
BFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
Every day on the show, we do the 5 at 5. Today is no different. We're going to lead you right into Thursday Night Football. We'll have a couple of hours of BFT Radio tomorrow leading you into the Mariners-Tigers Game 5. But first, Steven has prepared the 5 at 5. Let's do this.
The 5 at 5.
Here we go. Number one, John, is going to be down in Eugene as the Oregon Ducks are taking on Indiana for college game day in a big top 10 matchup on Saturday. The guest picker has been announced for college game day, and it will be once again Sabrina Ionescu. She will be the guest picker once again for college game day. Of course, she was also the guest picker back in 2022 when game day visited Eugene for the Oregon versus UCLA game. Sabrina, she went 6-4 on her picks that weekend on October 22nd. So pretty decent, about 500. Nice job out of Sabrina. But more importantly for the Ducks beat UCLA 45-30 that day. And I think that's what most people want, is a win over Indiana. But Sabrina Ionescu, the GOAT, as you might say, she'll be the one picking the games for College Game Day.
Love this. Love. I think the only important fact is that the Ducks won that day. I remember, I believe that was the return of Chip Kelly to Autzen Stadium. There was a lot of hoopla around it. Sabrina was there that day. It was a nice sunny day. Oregon won the football game. We're not going to get the same kind of weather Saturday in that one, but with Indiana in town, it should be a rainy, sort of gloomy October Saturday. But Sabrina looking for a 2-0 record as the guest picker.
Number two.
And I love this stuff. The annual NBA.com survey for all the league's 30 front offices has happened and has been put in. And the GMs have picked the Oklahoma City Thunder to defend their title. 80% of the GMs across the NBA picked OKC to win for a second straight year. If that does happen, it would be the first time since the Golden State Warriors repeated in 2018 that you have back-to-back champions. It's the logical choice to have Oklahoma City doing this. Now, there are rules to this. The annual survey goes out to all 30 teams, and you're not allowed to pick yourselves or anyone from your own roster. So, you know, Sam Presti cannot pick the Oklahoma City Thunder to win, even though he probably thinks they're going to win. But for the awards, for individual awards, Nuggets center Nikola Jokic, he claimed 67% of the votes for MVP, and he was a runaway winner there. Nuggets look like they have a really good roster this year. I actually think the Nuggets could be the second-best team in the Western Conference. And the other big one was Victor Wembanyama. He received 83% of the votes as the player GMs would pick if they had a chance to select anyone to start a franchise, which makes him a back-to-back winner in that category for the second straight season. And interesting enough, that actual award that they come up with of who you start a franchise with, there's been some bad picks gone. If you go back further, I remember Carl Anthony Towns was a pick then. Like, he's a good player, but that's not a guy you'd want to start your entire franchise with out of everybody in the league. But Wemby, second straight year that GMs pick him, and it's the right choice. But as I said yesterday, I believe it was Wembanyama listed at 7'5" now. He'd only be the 10th player in NBA history to be 7'5" or taller. Can't wait to see what he does this season. He should be incredible. And sadly, no Portland Trailblazers that I saw made the list for anything. But Blazers, look, I think they go over the win total. But just right now, they don't have anybody you build your team around. They don't have a team to win the championship. They're right where they belong. But, you know, Blazers, I think they have a shot. And I think Wemby's the right choice there.
I'll say what I said last year about the Blazers. I just want them to be relevant. I want them to be fun. I want Blazer fans to want to go to more games. You take your kids to a Blazer game, I want them to say as you're leaving, hey, I'd like to come back again sometime. Interesting to see the league GM's pick. Not surprised Wemby would be the player they start a franchise with. Eager to see what his career turns out to be.
Number three.
Also in basketball news, USA Basketball is expected to name former University of Portland star Eric Spoelstra as their new head coach of the men's national team, according to ESPN. Spoelstra will succeed Steve Kerr for the next World Cup and the 2028 Summer Olympics after he served as the lead assistant on Team USA's gold medal squad back in 2024. I mean, I think Spoelstra is probably the best head coach in the NBA right now. And I think you look at his X's and O's, what he's done, his story coming from University of Portland, being a video analyst, which I was. So, you know, I always have a little soft spot for me there. We had an expulsion. We had the same type of job when we first started in the NBA working for. I worked for the Blazers. He was working for the Heat. I love the choice. I think it's the right choice. I think, you know, it was a no-brainer to name Spoelstra the head coach of Team USA.
I love a success story, a homegrown success story. Spo, great job at UP, great job in the NBA, now getting the international stage. This is a good pick by USA Basketball, I think.
Number four.
Well, Bad Bunny was announced as the halftime performance at the Super Bowl, and that made some people very angry because a lot of his songs are in Spanish. We played them. So if you don't know Spanish, you may not know the words. Well, Turning Point USA, they have announced the, quote, all-American halftime show, end quote, to compete with the Super Bowl halftime show. Of course, Turning Point USA was headed by Charlie Kirk before his assassination or his murder that he had, you know, a couple weeks ago. But they are putting it on because of the objections to Bad Bunny's explicit lyrics and perceived anti-American themes. They do have a website up. I did go to it. And if you go to it, there's a sign-up sheet where, you know, you put all your information in. Then I imagine you get bombarded with a lot of spam email afterwards, which makes me not ever want to sign up for everything. But it then does ask, what type of music genres would you like to see featured And you can select all that apply. Here are the options. Anything in English, Americana, classic rock, country, hip-hop, pop, or worship. So we'll see what happens, but they look like they're going to have a competing halftime show. We'll see how that goes. I still imagine Bad Bunny's going to get a ton of viewers and a ton of people will probably break a lot of records.
I think we've talked about this at length, that like the Super Bowl's halftime show, the aim here is not to program to the people who are the diehard NFL fans who are already in the room. Their aim is to try to bring new audience in. They're trying to bring young, they're trying to bring Latin, they're trying to bring Spanish-speaking. The NFL and the halftime show, they know exactly what they're doing. Let's not be easily offended. Maybe the big winner are geography teachers and history teachers who can point out that Puerto Rico is a territory of the United States. So not considered to be a full-fledged state under international or domestic law, but it's a territory, for crying out loud.
Number five.
We got a busy sports night tonight. Thursday Night Football, of course, is why we're going off the air a little bit early. That's Eagles at the Giants. Eagles, they lost last week to the Broncos and Bo Nix in Philadelphia, while the Giants and Jackson Dart, they lost to New Orleans, down in New Orleans. This one's going to be in Jersey with the Eagles on the road. So that should be an interesting game in the NFC East. We also got Major League Baseball playoffs. Busy sports night going on here. Busy time for sports is all in general.
I saw a tweet by one of these Yahoos who tweets such things that We've got either a college football game or an NFL game or a baseball game or a basketball game for something like 64 straight days that we're about to endure. So there's no reason not to have your television on sports is what they're saying. That, the five biggest stories going on in sports. All right, I was able to track down Jim Moore, the go-to guy, earlier in the show. I love that interview with Jim Moore because we captured sort of the flavor of a Mariners fan and how what it means to Mariners fans to possibly break through and have a win in this Game 5 in tomorrow night's American League Division Series. We've talked earlier in the show with Rob Mullins, the Oregon Athletic Director. Fantastic interview with Mullins about the plans in Eugene and the thinking in Eugene. I think a lot of people wondering kind of where Oregon's mind will be. And the Big Ten Conference certainly exploring a lot of private equity and an outside investment. That's a lot to think about. We have a great Friday show lined up. As I mentioned earlier, it is a shortened Friday show. Because of the Mariners, they will get a 5:08 first pitch against the Detroit Tigers tomorrow in that pivotal Game 5, so you'll want to be here. We've got John Wilner of the Bay Area News Group on tomorrow's show, Chris Hampton, University of Oregon, co-defensive coordinator and defensive backs coach. He'll be on the show as well. He's got a great story. He played football at South Carolina. He played football for Lou Holtz and Steve Spurrier at South Carolina. Talk about playing for some legendary coaches and very, very different experiences. I always tell people I went from covering Bobby Knight as a beat reporter to covering Jerry Tarkanian. That was like a swing of the pendulum that was mighty. Chris Hampton went from playing for Lou Holtz to playing for Steve Spurrier. And you talk about playing for two different style coaches. I'll be curious to talk with Chris Hampton about that. Plus, he does a lot of recruiting for Oregon. And he previously was at Tulane. What's it like for Chris Hampton when he picks up the phone or reaches out to a recruit and he's got the Oregon brand behind him when he walks on a campus or he leaves a message? How different is that than when you're at Tulane and you're making that same call? We'll talk with him about that. And then John Wilner's making the trek to the Pacific Northwest. He's doing the Washington-Rutgers game tomorrow night, Friday night game. And then Saturday, he'll be at Oregon, Indiana. And we're going to drive down together on that one. I'm going to talk to Wilner about his expectations for all of the Pacific Northwest teams. Is it a trap game for Wake Forest? Does Washington State stand a chance, a 32.5-point underdog at Mississippi? A lot of interesting storylines this weekend in college football. We'll be all over it. But first, we've got a Thursday night football game to deal with. And you've got it right here on 750 The Game. Leave it locked in.